then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of...
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 6th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Okay, we have a lot of guest speakers this week on Radio Free Northwest, but let me lay a few opening comments on you first. And I'd like to remind you guys why it is that we have these guests on here, some of them in person here with me in what passes for our studio, and a lot more in the form of MP3 audio files that people send me via email attachment. When I first started Radio Free Northwest back in the thrilling days of yesteryear, i.e. back in January of 2010, the first few episodes were, like most right-wing and racial podcasts and shows and cassette tapes, basically it was just me sitting here babbling for 45 minutes or an hour, and even I could tell when I played them back that I was probably boring people out of their minds. That's why I introduced the first music breaks. It wasn't just because I'm a frustrated disc jockey, but because I needed something to break up the hoarse monotone of my own voice. Plus, it's bad psychology to have no one but me on here. The NF needs to project the idea correctly that we are an actual movement, however small, and it's not just Harold sitting here all alone in a little room talking to himself on the computer. Now, God knows it really is like that for a lot of our people. We really are completely isolated, most of us, in whatever city or town we live in. It's like we're wrapped in a cocoon. You have to recall that probably most of, quote-unquote, our people have never even met another white nationalist in person, mostly because we're terrified to peep out from behind the computer even for a moment. Now, that's how frightened and timid and isolated we are. I will never forget all those months and years that Jeff Hughes and I both begged and pleaded for someone, anyone, among the dozens of white racial internet posters in the Vancouver, Canada area, people whom we knew were there, to step forward and identify themselves and meet with Jeff and give him a hand. No one ever did, but on the night that he was murdered by the police, the whole incident was at least partly witnessed and described on Stormfront by a poster who lived across the street from Jeff's apartment building. All those months and years while this comrade fought on all alone against the drug dealers and the RCMP hate crime squad and the ignorance and the apathy of our own people, all that time, there was another so-called white nationalist living across the street from him, who was too terrified to show his face above the computer terminal and even step across the street to help this man. In his epic novel, 1984, George Orwell described Winston Smith's dangerous decision to begin a diary or a journal as springing from a desire to finally release the endless, running monologue that had been going on in his head for years. I think we're all familiar with that phenomenon. We American white people are a race of Winston Smiths. Like Winston Smith, we live all alone in the world of Big Brother that surrounds us, wondering if anyone else sees the same things that we see and thinks the same criminal thoughts and doubts and questions that we think. Well, the answer is yes, they do. Or rather, the answer is, no, you are not all alone. And now you can let the running monologue in your head out. You'll have to be sufficiently tech-savvy on your computer to figure out how to make an MP3 file of your own voice. But once you do, you can send it to me, and unless it's completely insane or off the wall or preaching communism or buggery or something like that, I'll put it on the air. As to what I define as completely nuts, I think it's probably best to avoid any mention of either Atlantis or UFOs. And by the way, I'm not saying that neither of those exist. Maybe they do. And sometimes I like to talk about Atlantis and UFOs and poltergeists and whatnot, but in view of who's probably listening, I think we should most likely keep such topics off Radio Free Northwest. Beyond that, pretty much anything goes. It doesn't have to be a good audio file, technically speaking. We can do some editing and some filtering and whatnot, so long as it comes from the heart. So long as it comes from that endless monologue that goes around in your head, and I'm sure has been there for years, as it has been with all of us. That long observation, that long stream of consciousness, awareness, I think you all understand what I mean, the knowledge that something in this society is so badly wrong, so badly broken, and we see it, but we can't talk about it. We know that for our own safety, we have to keep it secret, keep it hidden away inside us, because it's dangerous to speak in this society. Free speech is bullshit. Now, as long as whatever you send me comes from that part of you and it serves the 14 words, then fine. This is the place where you can let the long-running monologue out of your head and it can be heard. Anyway, we have some comments now from Gretchen the Librarian on Ayn Rand. And yes, I know Ayn Rand was a Jew. Every now and then, we're going to run into Jews whose lives and work occasionally impinge on what we do. And that applies in the case of Ayn Rand, who has some fans on the periphery of the movement, believe it or not, mostly among the Ron Paul crowd. Now, don't ask me how anyone in white nationalism ever got the idea that Ron Paul is in some way one of us or worth supporting. I've never quite grasped that one. But there are some people who are just so anxious for some kind of permission slip to dissent, some kind of affirmation from someone, anyone inside the system or in the celebrity cult, that they will grasp at straws, and Ron Paul is a straw that a lot of us grasp at. He is not a racial nationalist or a racialist of any kind. Ron Paul has repeatedly said so, and indeed he has begged us to stay away from his political campaigns because he doesn't want us embarrassing him. But it all seems to go in one ear and out the other. Some of our otherwise squared away people are just fascinated with him, and of course, once you get into libertarianism, you get into Ayn Rand. So anyway, here's Gretchen.
Good evening, comrades. This spring, Harold sent me a copy of the Occidental Quarterly. This quarterly was all about libertarianism, and it also made, in two or three places, it made mention of Ayn Rand. I found this relatively fascinating because when I was a teenager, I focused on white nationalism a lot, and at one point I made an argument to somebody that the perhaps selfishness of the white race in the form of white preservation is really best for everyone. Then I was that, well, you're just like Ayn Rand, you should read her books. So I looked her up, and I found out that she was a Russian Jewish woman, and I, at that point, decided that that comment was rather off the wall, and I decided that I'm not really sure that she could be helpful to me, so I just moved on from there and didn't give it too much more thought. But when I read the Occidental Quarterly, it reminded me of that conversation, so I decided to make a study of Ayn Rand's ideas to find out what was of interest to other people, and particularly in our circles about her, despite her ethnicity. So I wound up reading two books on her, one of them by a supporter called The Passion of Ayn Rand, and then a second one called The Cult of Ayn Rand, which is a book that tends to be very critical of her. And I think together they make a nice contrast, and they gave me a sense of her personality. The Cult of Ayn Rand talks about Ayn Rand as really a Jewish thinker, even though she wasn't a liberal thinker. She was a Jewish thinker that wanted actually less government interference. But even so, she still falls into the realm of what you might call Jewish intellectualism. This comes up in the sense that in much of Judaism, you have an interest in people while they're alive. There isn't really as much of an interest in an afterlife in many forms of Judaism. And that's one of the things that she exhibited. She put an emphasis on the rational and could prove an emphasis on ability and an awareness of superiority and being proud to be superior. She also was very interested in survival as a special being. Although, in her case, this interest in survival has some irony because Ayn was never interested in family. She was very interested in her writing career, and she chose to focus on that, so she really had no interest in having children. So her work tends to focus on individuals, and it never seems to take into account family life at all. Also in her work, the characters tend to be very Americanized and very Anglo-Saxon, and in the Quarterly, there is some thought or there is some question as to why her characters are always so very white. I tend to think that the reason for that was simply the fashion of the day and the interest on Americanism at that time and how it was thought of in those days. You have to remember that she was writing pretty much the 50s, and the demographics were quite different in those days. The book talks about her debt to other writers, even though she never admitted this debt, and it lists several writers. One of them is H.G. Wells, a writer that I've always enjoyed to the extent that I've looked at his work. The other writer that it mentions is the author of Little House on the Prairie books, which is actually Rose Wilder Lane, even though I always thought that it was Laura Ingalls Wilder that had written these books, but this book claims that that was actually a bit of, not a pseudonym, but a bit of stretching the truth. And the other thing that I found very entertaining about the Ayn Rand cult is that at around page 247, you get a very humorous look at Ayn Rand because she was an individual that relied so heavily on her intellect that anything physical world was very difficult for her. So I found that very humorous. All in all, I think that this book gave me a good sense of her and a sense of why people who lean towards the more libertarian aspects of the movement would find something valuable in her. The other thing is, of course, that if you didn't want to read her, you could read the authors that she's indebted to and the books that are mentioned. I found this little study, although it was a bit of a digression, I found it interesting to learn about the libertarian aspects of our movement. Honestly, within these Jewish intellectuals, because they are very smart, they can make at times some interesting points here and there. So I really found that to be somewhat worthwhile. Although I would say that I'm not sure that there is any need particularly to read her. I'm not opposed to reading them, but in the Ayn Rand cult, it said that her work is simplistic and dated, essentially. I'm not quite ready to say that since I haven't read her work. I don't like to talk about books that I personally haven't read because I might not agree with the reviewer. I would say that there is most likely some truth to that view. Another interesting point is that the author of the Ayn Rand cult, who is someone by the name of Jeff Walker, who I could find out very little about, but he does state that her work is often just as good as in comic books as it is in full text, which also makes me think that her work must be somewhat simplistic if it can do that. But, no, what can I say? That it's been interesting, and I really wanted to find out why other people liked her so much. So, thank you for listening.
Okay, Axis Sally's up next, but before we bring her on, I want to toss in a couple of quick comments here on a topic which I'm forced to address about every 3 or 4 months here on Radio Free Northwest, And that is that there's a resurgence of goat dancing on the internet this week. And as always with this crap, it generated a few emails from newer people who aren't familiar with the cast of characters and who are sitting through this silly movie for the first time, and so they don't get it and they want to know what's going on and why is this alleged white nationalist saying all these horrible things about me on the internet, yada, yada, yada. White Americans don't do subtlety and they don't handle nuance or complexity well. To a large degree, this is because their comprehension is formed through television. And so every few months, we get one of these outbursts, and I have to try and explain in the simplest possible terms to new people what's going on and break it to them as gently as I can that we have some people in our movement who claim to be us who have no business being involved or being anywhere near us. Now, what happened in this case is that I and the Northwest Migration were both endorsed on YouTube by a Jew, believe it or not. And the way the usual two or three suspects reacted, you would have thought that I was secretly videotaped addressing a convention of the Elders of Zion or whatever. Now, I'm familiar with the individual in question, and he isn't anybody of any importance at all in the Jewish world or the Jewish power structure. He's just a nut. Jews get them just like we do. But if you ask the usual suspects from that 90s show, this proves that I am secretly a part of the world Jewish conspiracy, and I am, in fact, the Grand Rabbi of Jerusalem in disguise. No. I don't know what else to tell you, folks. This character is a Jewish kook. There are plenty of them out there. I've never had any contact with him. He made this YouTube video and uploaded it without consulting me in any way, and I have nothing to do with anything he says on there. Needless to say, at the same time, the YouTube management Hebes are hunting down all of our NF and NVA videos by Colonel House and others and pulling them offline as fast as they can be detected. All of this weirdo Kike's videos are still up and untouched. Now, beyond that, guys, I don't know what else to say except that we have some people who really need to escape from the time warp that's locked them perpetually into 1996 and who need to learn when their 15 minutes is over. Now me, I had my 15 minutes back in 1979 and 1980, and I'm glad it's over. It was not an edifying experience. It's not something I would want to go through again. Anyway, here's Sally.
Hey guys, this is Axis Sally, and here are some basic precautions. What follows are suggestions to help keep us out of trouble discovered the hard way by people who continue to pay the price. 1. Beware of all strangers. Historically, resistance to tyrants has taken the form of small autonomous groups whose members know and trust one another from long experience. 2. Beware of the man who is too perfect. He says all the right things, needs little persuasion, plus he supplies a substantial amount of money. 3. Beware of handling someone else's firearms, or you may find your fingerprints showing up at a crime scene. 4. Be doubly aware of a stranger who proposes illegal activities. You will soon find him testifying against you in federal court. 5. Beware of those who draw checks from the enemy. They are likely to have divided loyalties. 6. Avoid drunks, drug users, and anyone of unstable character. Always choose quality over quantity. 7. Beware of someone whose intellect, education, and background appear different from those with whom he attempts to associate. Most people interrelate with others of similar interests and background. 8. Do a little investigation. To be sure, the Federals can create a good cover, but they seldom bother because up to now, resistance groups have almost never checked their associates' background. 9. Recognize the ruthlessness of the tyrant and act accordingly. A government which will mass murder innocent families, including women and children, is not going to play fair with you. 10. Beware of signing up for any militia organization, or you could find yourself taking orders from FEMA. 11. Recognize the media's tactics. Do not react to buzzwords, religious separatists, white supremacists, tax protesters, cultists, Nazis, and other words which the masses are conditioned to hate. After the media has demonized the target, as in Ruby Ridge and Waco, the government is free to murder as it chooses. We must create our own means of informing the masses to cause them to be sympathetic to our cause, to learn to fish in friendly waters. We must be committed to spreading the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Endeavor always to send messages which will ring true in the ears of our countrymen. There is an enormous amount of moral and ideological high ground which has been abandoned by our foes. Claim it and use it. As our cause continues to rapidly grow in numbers and knowledge, it has not been without pain. We must all bear in mind that we are volunteers from all walks of life. Each of us must guard against ego eruptions. To be a good leader, you must first be willing to be a servant. Study the book, The Art of War, over and over. You must earn respect. Don't demand it. Keep it simple, building from the bottom up, private cells and public meetings. Have you ever tried to build a house starting with the shingles first? The party is as strong as the preparedness of each individual family. If you can't eat it, wear it, shoot it, do you really need it? What good are your guns and bullets if your stomach is empty and your feet are bloody or frozen? The Irish poet William Butler Yeats wrote in a famous poem, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold." So it is in America. This country is coming apart at the seams. No one in authority will act because to do so would mean acknowledging the realities of race and the complete moral bankruptcy of the whole philosophy of liberal democracy. That has been rendered unthinkable in a society where even the mildest of racial remarks or deviation from racial orthodoxy by anyone within the establishment results in dismissal from employment and savage demonization by the media. The latest sign of this society's deep and irreversible sickness is the present campaign on the part of organized perversion to grant legal recognition to their loathsome couplings under the name of same-sex marriage. The latest triumph of this abomination took place last week in the state of New York. I'm surprised it took all those Jews and faggots who live there that long. If there is such a thing as the ultimate depravity and betrayal of basic human decency, it is this obscenity. A comrade recently wrote to me and said, "Sally, I honestly believe that's it. With homosexual marriage, America has reached rock bottom, we can't sink any lower, and we've nowhere to go but up." I disagree, and not alone, because experience has shown that liberal democracy is always capable of sinking to further depths no matter what. There is one final perversion which I now predict the federal government will attempt to impose at some point in the future. That's the legal prohibition of same-race marriages. No joke, people. I honestly believe that at some point in the future, after massive gun control and confiscation is achieved, it is part of Zog's hidden agenda to impose diversity by force. Your grandchildren may be legally required to marry non-whites in order to implement an official policy of, quote-unquote, eliminating racism by eliminating race. That term is already making its appearance in the media. Sexual congress within or outside marriage between a white man and woman will become illegal because it might lead to the birth of a white infant. Think I'm paranoid? 30 years ago, who would have believed in over 20 million murdered babies? Who would have believed that doctors would be given the right to kill their sick and elderly patients? Who would have believed that faggots and lesbians would seriously demand the right to marry? The communists used to call this technique the salami slicer. Slice by thin slice, they take away white Americans' rights, and drop by drop, they fill our world with filth. The people who rule us are evil. There is nothing that they will not attempt in order to impose their insane agenda if they think they can get away with it. Understanding that is vital to our racial survival, and the movement for an independent white Northwest Republic is vital to bringing this vile world crashing down and building our own in its place.
This is Final Solution.
Blind. sympathy is out there, but the books won't spark the light. They need to witness victory and see how people fight. Ooh, a revolution. Final solution. There ain't no turning back.
Well, this is Harold, and we're here once again with Comrade Charles Martel for a little off-the-cuff discussion here. Charles and I were bullshitting out there in the living room a while ago. I made a few notes just to see if we could get some of this on the air. It's one of those cases, I'm sure every one of us has been there. You're having some kind of good BS session or discussion going, and you're saying, damn, I wish I had a recorder, or I wish this was, you know, on the air for Radio Free Northwest. So I actually made a few notes, and let's see how this turns out. First note I've got here on my little 3x5 card is we were talking about immigration and how immigration is bad for everybody, including the immigrants.
Yeah, it's like everybody's complaining bitterly about the Arabs, especially in England. I don't blame them because they're coming in by the plane loads and the ship loads. But then you have to stop and think about why they're coming in such droves. And that's because first we go over there and bomb the crap out of their countries, turn them all into refugees, and then we say, oh, well, come on over here. And so all these people that are destitute pour into England or the United States or the rest of Western Europe. And of course, the problem is they've just seen their relatives blown up back in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever the hell they come from. And they're all pissed off. And then, of course, we're all kind of amazed that they become terrorists. So who's thinking up that crazy idea that we bomb them and then we turn them into refugees and then we let them into our country? I mean, that's a recipe for disaster if I ever saw one.
Well, in England, a lot of the problem is that a lot of their WOG immigrants of various kinds come from former Commonwealth countries, specifically India, Pakistan, places like that. And when the Brits pulled out of these countries back in the 1940s after they had just defeated the Third Reich and decided that they needed to celebrate their victory over the wicked evil Germans by dismantling their own empire, when they did that, they created this British Commonwealth that gave Commonwealth citizens automatic right of residence within Britain itself. And needless to say, all of these WOGs who were living in these little wattle and turf villages on the banks of the Ganges or whatever decided that they would far rather live in a council flat in Bermondsey or a council house in Sheffield or something and get the British taxpayer to pay for their accommodation and pay for all their benefits and pay for their medical care on the National Health Service than stay in their little hut on the banks of the Ganges and get eaten by crocodiles and shit on by the sacred Brahma bulls and whatnot, all this sort of stuff. So they proceeded to pack their bags and they proceeded to flood Britain. And the situation there is somewhat different from this country because in Britain, most of these WOGs are not actually illegal aliens. Technically speaking, they're entitled to live there because of this Commonwealth BS, whereas here, the Mexicans and the various third worlders that are overrunning America are technically speaking illegal. We've just decided to ignore the fact. Our illustrious president, Barry Satoro, has recently decided just to simply stop deporting them.
Well, I mean, that's all true, too. But the other thing is you really have to step back and look at the big picture and ask yourself not what's happening, but why it's happening. The immigrants themselves cause a lot of problems, but those are structural and they're caused by any big mass population shift. That's just what happens. Most invasions in the history of the world weren't by armies. They were by nations on the move for various economic or climactic reasons. So you have to step back and ask yourself, why did they suddenly change the immigration laws back in 64 and throw the floodgates open for anybody in the world? Well, the same reason they did it back in the 20s and back in the 1800s, it's all about labor. It's all about the capitalists or the people at the factories wanting to bring in cheap labor to undercut the native workers. And they do it again and again and again. In fact, the first immigrants to this country to do that were actually from Europe. They were bringing in Southern Europeans to undercut the Northern European workers that had come over before the revolution. So there's a reason this is going on, and the reason that has nothing to do with the benefit of the immigrants or, and for sure, the benefit of the rest of us. It's a way to chop us up into small groups so that they can more easily control us and exploit us all.
Of course, the main problem with these immigrants today that didn't exist with the older waves of immigrants back in the Ellis Island days is that these immigrants are black, they are brown, they are both racially and culturally non-assimilable in a way that, say, the Irish and the Italians, the Poles and whatnot were not. In the old Ellis Island days, they talked about the melting pot. Well, the melting pot will melt up to a certain point as long as the people that you're trying to melt together are assimilable within a certain degree. They're racially assimilable. They're culturally more or less assimilable. They were all more or less Christians, except for the Jews, of course. But beyond a certain point, you cannot melt, you cannot meld two disparate races of people who have nothing in common biologically, culturally, religiously, or in any way, shape, and form whatsoever. You can make a nation, an American nation, if you want to call it that, by combining Italians, Poles, Germans, Irishmen, whatever. You cannot make an American or any other kind of nation by trying to meld or melt together Hindus, Jews, African niggers from Somalia and Ethiopia, Eskimos, mestizos from the jungles of Yucatan, and the scum of the Middle East, Arabs, you name it. There's a certain point beyond which the melting pot fails to melt, and what you have is not a melting pot making a nice little tasty American stew. What you've got is an inedible mess that eventually is going to reach a certain compression point, and it's going to explode.
Well, that's for sure. And the thing that's really aggravating about the whole thing is it's not like this hasn't been tried before for the last 3,000 or 4,000 years. A nation is some kind of dictator or strongman who basically conquers all of his neighboring clans, and he forms a nation, but they're all related genetically and culturally. But then he gets big-itis and decides he's going to start taking over all the surrounding countries. So that's where the empire comes in, and so he's faced with having all these different groups of very different people under one government, and they become unmanageable or very difficult to manage. And that's the problem with empire. And every empire in the history of the world has fallen apart because those kind of disparate groups just don't get along. And you see it in this country right now. Back when they're bringing in different kinds of Europeans, they would gradually meld together after a while. But what we see now is they're not melting. They're actually forming their own little clans and nation states in the United States. You know, back in the old days when I was a kid, they had Chinatown or Little Tokyo or whatever little ethnic group had moved into that area. Like in Idaho, the Basque sheep herders had been brought over to herd sheep. And so there are all these little enclaves of Basques that are still there in like Nevada and southern Idaho. But now you've got whole tribes of Somali warriors in Minneapolis or Lewiston, Maine, whatever that place is.
Yeah.
And so everywhere you go, they're not melding in. They're not really becoming Americans. They are Mexican Americans, they're Somali Americans, and they're forming their own little cultures and countries in the United States. And of course, what have they done? They've taken to fighting each other. I mean, we're always complaining about all the crime against white people, but geez, I mean, down in like places like California and Texas and back east, they're fighting their civil wars here in the United States. And it's tearing our country apart the same way that every other empire has been torn apart. We don't do something about it now. The problem itself will do something about it, and that will break down into about a five-way civil war in this country.
Well, another problem is a kind of negative immigration. They're starting to experience this in England. Now, they refer to it as the British brain drain, and it's a fancy way of saying that the white people in England and the UK with any intelligence, any entrepreneurial skills, with any assets, with any education, with any talents or abilities, are actually beginning to flee the country. And various media types and social researchers and whatnot have tracked these people down and asked them why they are leaving England or the United Kingdom, wherever they're, you know, Scotland, wherever they're leaving from. And in many cases, they'll be quite honest about it. They will tell you that it is because of the high number of non-assimilable alien third world immigrants that are coming into England and the complete inability and unwillingness of the government to do anything about it.
Well, that's really interesting because actually this has all happened before. Remember, the Celts were in England when the Saxons decided to invade in about 400 AD thereabouts. And basically a lot of the Celts, or as they called themselves, Britons in those days, left England and went back over to France. And that's where you get Brittany. So we're seeing the same thing happening again as the new wave of immigrants are actually driving the native Anglo-Saxons out who are moving someplace else.
Yeah, but once again, back in the Dark Ages, though, those waves of assorted conquerors and fleeing tribes and whatnot were racially assimilable. They were able to create eventually a sort of British nation, largely on the basis of a shared racial background and cultural background, because virtually all white people are descended from a common ancestor. You know, your Normans and your Saxons and your Celts and your Irish and your Welsh. Believe it or not, we all go back to that same group of wandering tribes from around Central Asia. The languages have common roots. They had more or less a common religion, etc., etc. But above all, they were racially and biologically assimilable. When you made it a Welsh person and a British person or an English person, you still got a white man or woman. You got a white baby. These new waves of immigrants are not assimilable. And when you have intermixture between Wogs and Pakistanis and Somalis and white women, which is usually the case, and it's usually by rape or coercion or selling them drugs or all the various sick, mental, twisted mental reasons why white women marry Wogs. I've been to London, and you walk around London, and it's a very common sight to see some white girl rolling a pram down the street with one or two mulatto babies in the pram. But that type of diversity does not strengthen, it destroys. These latest waves of immigration into Europe are not melding, they're not assimilating, they're not creating a stronger strain, which the various conquests of the British Isles did. They are destroying the racial element that created the civilization in the countries in the first place. Getting back to my little card here, let's see what's next. Oh, yeah. We were talking about techno-geeks versus real scientists early.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite.
Tesla?
Actually, the last real scientist was Tesla. Nowadays, basically, scientists or research scientists are only interested in one thing, and that's their next grant. And to get their grant, they have to sell their idea to somebody with money. And right now, the money men are the people that run everything. And what the money men want, they want a total surveillance state. So they're just drunk on the idea of supercomputers and drones in the sky and all that mumbo jumbo. And of course, since they themselves don't really know anything about science, they're easily sold a bill of goods by all these techno geeks who convince them that they can basically put into place this giant supercomputer that will keep track of everybody in the world and monitor everybody all the time. But the problem with that is it won't work because, as any real scientist knows, the more complex the system, the more likely error is to creep in. This whole worldwide, whatever you want, surveillance state, it simply won't work for practical reasons.
Yeah. I was telling Charles that I don't generally watch that much TV, but one series that I will get when it's on DVD is 24 for a couple of reasons. Number one, I love to watch Jack Bauer torture people. But number two, it's kind of like you can see the system, the FBI or whoever, trotting out all their little surveillance toys that they're so proud of. In the last episode, for example, they've got drones flying all over New York City and identifying suspects with facial recognition from the sky. And anytime Jack Bauer wants the skinny on one of the bad guys or the good guys or whatever, he calls that little geeky girl, Chloe, and says, "Chloe, I need blah, 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 blah." And Chloe will tap her keyboard, and all of a sudden she's got this guy's whole life story in front of her on a screen. And there are other shows that have this type of thing, Criminal Minds and whatnot. It's almost like the FBI is boasting or trying to intimidate people by saying, "Hey, see, we know where you are. We can spy on you. We can find out your whole life story. We've got everything on our databases. There's no escape," type of thing. So I personally question how effectively this would function in real life if the feds ever were confronted with a real NVA or other insurgency type situation for several reasons. Number one, I'm not at all sure the technology is that good. Number two, you got to bear in mind we're dealing with the federal government here and with the system that is weighed down with affirmative action and all of the other problems that politically correct government has. And it doesn't really matter if you've got most super-duper surveillance system in the world if you've got some dumb nigger with an IQ of 65 trying to operate it. So,
yeah, trust me, it won't work because it's already not working. Our current foreign adventures prove it. The whole idea of the U.S. military now is that it's high-tech, and we can fight these high-tech wars and whoop everybody by flying around in drones and killing people. And the problem is it's not working. I mean, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, and all the other little
Libya, Yemen,
every other
the
little
Philippines
little desert war.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel bad for the common soldier because, like every other stupid war, it's a poor man's fight and a rich man's war. the thing is, we're getting our asses kicked in all those countries because it won't work. A bunch of guys with homemade guns are able to defeat all of our high-tech weaponry. It's the same thing in Vietnam. They were doing all this stuff in Vietnam. They had all these sensors along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they had all these surveillance planes flying around. It didn't work.
Well, now, yeah, they kill people with Predators. They had a big to-do last week about killing that so-called, quote, American-born cleric. And by the way, that's a very interesting case because it's a case where the President of the United States, in essence, authorized the murder of an American citizen with no trial, no judge, no jury, nothing. Just go kill him, and they did. So that's another little line that's been crossed. But that aside, okay, they used a Predator drone to whack this WOG, and it worked in that case. If they're telling us the truth, which, you know, with this government is always a big assumption, but you may remember if you follow certain websites like antiwar.com that half the time these so-called drone attacks don't work. They'll blow up some Afghan wedding or an Iraqi elementary school or something like that. And of course, needless to say, when the drones miss and they kill the wrong people, or when the drones don't go off, or when the drones just go crashing into the desert and, you know, blow up a couple of goats, that story appears and it disappears. And then, you know, on the rare occasions when it works, they say, yeah, yeah, our super technology just wiped out Ahmed, you know, whatever his name is, who is the second in command of Al-Qaeda. And of course, we have no idea if any of this is true. I just frankly do not believe that if an actual insurgency situation ever took place in the United States, that this technology would be all that effective for a variety of political and technological reasons. And so this naysay that we get, oh, we can never revolt, Harold, we can never resist, they'll just use all their computers to find us and they'll send drones after us, and oh, it's impossible, no, no, we mustn't do anything, we just must keep on tapping on our computers and posting the storm front, no, no, no. Oh, Harold.
You know, just, well, you know, you get the idea. Well, you know, if they're going to send a drone, why don't they just send one to your IP address? That seems a lot more efficient than But the point is, that whole thing in toasting that poor old dude over there in Yemen with a drone proves my point, and it proves the whole point of the Northwest Front. Low tech can defeat high tech any day, and I'll tell you why. How many millions of dollars did it take to take out that one poor little old guy over there in Yemen? Millions of dollars. How many dollars would it take for some guerrilla in Afghanistan or Vietnam or Salem, Oregon to take out some super soldier? What does one bullet cost? 25 cents? The numbers are wrong. They spend millions of dollars to kill one guy, and the guerrillas spend 25 cents, which they probably actually got that bullet off of their enemies.
I'm going to go on a limb here. This is probably approaching the line of things I'm not supposed to say, but we've had four presidents assassinated in this country in our history. Five, if you want to count Reagan, who was actually hit, but he wasn't killed. And those five presidential hits, you might say, used weapons which cost somewhat less than $150 for all five guns that whacked four presidents and wounded one. John Wilkes Booth's little Derringer cost a couple of bucks at the time. Guiteau and Chalgosh both used junk guns that they got in pawn shops or whatever for $4 or $5. The rifle that Oswald used to kill Kennedy with, he apparently ordered by mail for $12.95. And John Hinckley used a junky old RG-22 revolver. I don't know exactly what he paid for it, but back in the early 1980s, those things were going for maybe $30 or $40 each in a pawn shop or a gun shop. So, you know, the actual damage that's been done to this system by firearms at the top in the Oval Office itself has been inflicted for probably less than about $150. So it just goes to show that you don't have to have a multi-million dollar missile system to inflict damage on the enemy. And I'd better shut up because the Secret Service will probably claim I'm conspiring to do something here. But, well, fuck them if they can't take a joke.
Well, but it's true. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. I mean, it has been proved over and over and over again that a low-tech army can defeat a high-tech army every time because it breaks the high-tech country. And it's broken this country. I mean, I don't know if anybody's bothered to pay any attention to the economic news, but, you know, we're all going down the tubes, and we're going down fast. And yet what? We're going to start, what, how many more wars did we start last week? Let's see. We invaded Libya, Yemen, and some places even I've never heard of. And we haven't even...
Any place with oil.
Yeah, right. I forgot that part. But, I mean, I don't know why we haven't invaded Rwanda. They're killing lots of, or they were killing lots of people there, but I guess they don't have any oil.
There's no oil in Rwanda. No, that's exactly,
right, exactly
why.
You know, if you don't have any oil, we don't give a damn about you, no matter who you are or what color you are. You got oil, we want to help.
Well, I can guarantee you that there are certain parts of Africa that if the situation ever did start getting really unstable, we would invade the parts with the diamonds. I personally don't think they would ever allow Rhodesia or Zimbabwe, as it is now, to get too far down the tubes because it's a very important source of chrome, that sort of stuff. But as far as Darfur and Rwanda, I mean, nobody cared about all those niggers in Rwanda. The only thing that Rwanda had was the gorillas in the mist, and I think the Hutu and the Tutsi, when they were massacring each other, killed all the gorillas as well, so probably mistook them for each other. But anyway, the thing is that... But anyway, you get the point I'm trying to make. People, we have got to stop being afraid to resist, to do anything, to stand up for our rights, to change the situation, because we're so terrified of what our lords and masters will do to us with their mighty, godlike technology, because it's not that effective, and it even if it was, like any weapon, technology is only as good as the people who are using it against you.
And I really got some bad news for everybody. They already know where you are, and the only reason they don't come and get you is because they can't. Trust me, if they could just round us all up tomorrow, they'd do it and solve the problem, but they can't round us up. They don't have the power. It's all a big bluff.
Right. The United States is going to fall, and it's going to fall for reasons that have nothing to do with their technology or with their power or with their will to do harm. It's going to fall for very human reasons involving economics and the state of the human soul, if you will.
These days will be remembered by America's noble sons. If it hadn't have been for Irishmen, what would your Union done? Hand to hand we fought 'em, all in the burning sun. Stripped to the pants, we did advance at the Battle of Bull Run.
Hey, this is Harold. I'm making this on Wednesday morning, and what's happened is last night I got sick as a dog, and this morning I once again feel like about 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag, and I just really, really don't feel like doing my long rant and rave for Radio Free Northwest this week, writing out the script and rising to heights of impassioned oratory, so forth and so on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to cheat. I am going to pull a section from Radio Free Northwest from last January the 13th. It is regarding the Gabrielle Giffords shooting by that weirdo Jared Loughner. And there's also another repetition of the Joseph Stack thing that I did. And I'm going to just drop that in here, and we'll have to let that wind up this week's Radio Free Northwest, because right now I really, honest to God, feel like crap. I'm supposed to do a radio interview tonight at about 5 o'clock Pacific time. I hopefully will be able to stumble through that, but I probably won't sound too good. Anyway, I apologize, but sometimes you just got to cut a few corners, and this episode of Radio Free Northwest is going to be one of those times. So let's get in the Wayback Machine and go back to January the 13th of this year. Now, wouldn't you know it, this is, of course, the very weekend that something has come up which I need to comment on. And since I'm making this podcast so early, I have to do so before all the facts are in, and by the time you actually hear the podcast, this whole commentary may be inoperative in some way. I'm referring, of course, to the shooting of a Jew congresswoman, her Jewish aide, and a federal judge in a Safeway in Arizona by a young white man whose name is apparently Jared Loughner, along with a number of other people, race unknown, and the race of the other victims is in fact highly relevant in determining whether or not this young man was racially and politically motivated. Now, so far, all the attention is on the two Jews and the judge, and we haven't been allowed to learn this information by the media as to exactly who else was shot and what color they were. But again, this is early days, and by the time the podcast is uploaded, new information may have come out that invalidates everything I say here. Now, that's just the risk I have to take. Now, in view of the contents of one section of my Radio Free Northwest broadcast for January the 6th, that's last week, there is some possibility that the regime may try somehow to cast the blame for this attack against the Democratic establishment on your friend and humble narrator, meaning me. I don't think so. I think they're after bigger game. And they'll try to hang this with equal inaccuracy on the Tea Party and then Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck. The latest news is that Obama's secret police are apparently trying to pin this on Jared Taylor, an American Renaissance of all people, calling him anti-Semitic. Oh, for crying out loud! If that's an example of the FBI and the SPLC's so-called intelligence-gathering skills, then we're in a lot better shape than I thought. Now, anyone who described American Renaissance as anti-Jewish clearly doesn't know their ass from a hole in the ground. Jared Taylor has rabbis to speak at his conferences. He's got some kind of tame neocon rabbi on his staff. And according to persistent movement rumor, he's supposedly married to a Jew, although, by the way, I have never seen any actual documentation on that last bit. That's just one of these things that flies all over the internet, and no one actually seems to have any details on it. By the way, I was also supposed to be married to a Jew at one stage. This was at a time when I wasn't married at all, but, I mean, you know, internets, you know, don't, well, logic isn't really their strong point, and I'm babbling again. Anyway, it would explain, however, why American Renaissance is so great on race, and yet Taylor allows not so much as a whisper about the Jewish question. Now remember A.K. Chesterton's motto, if they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. Jared Taylor doesn't name the Jew. He's not anti-Semitic, and apparently the connection between this guy who fired the shots and American Renaissance is that this Loughner character visited his website. Which, I guess, that's going to become a crime or some kind of federal offense now. Who knows? When the American Renaissance thing doesn't pan out, and after Limbaugh and Glenn Beck fall all over themselves, backtracking and groveling and denying any responsibility, it's possible that the regime's secret police may decide to settle for lesser game and I'll get a visit. If only to try and rattle my cage and maybe see if they can make me walk back what I've been saying and writing for the past 10 years, if only by way of an experiment. Ain't happening, guys. Now, for the record, I have no idea who Jared Loughner is, but neither can I swear to anyone that he is not among my weekly 3,000 or so listeners to Radio Free Northwest. It's been suggested on some of the other forums that Loughner is a Jew and a lefty himself, and for all I know, that may be true. Like I've said, we're still in that confused first 48 hours of one of these incidents where nobody really knows what the hell happened, and the media are simply adding to the confusion by putting out a lot of unverified crap. Like I've said, by the time this podcast airs on Wednesday or Thursday, the whole situation here may have changed. Now, because I'm working with a serious lack of data, I'm not going to really get into this situation now. But I will state for the record that unlike the Tea Party idiots, or no doubt Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck on tomorrow morning's show, I have no intention of trying to walk back or retract anything I've ever said or written other than the simple statement of fact that I do not know this man and I am not responsible for any moral or political decisions he may or may not have made. You guys will remember that I have described such a possible scenario of events before, wherein the regime attempts to establish a connection between me and my novels in the Northwest Independence Movement and the actions of someone I've never heard of. If they can't succeed in establishing a Tea Party or Limbaugh or Beck connection, and those guys are going to be their primary targets, they may be content with a lesser target. Now, just a standard warning. whenever this kind of thing happens, and it is going to be happening a lot in the future, everyone needs to make sure that their own premises are raid ready. Make sure that there is nothing in your house or on your property that shouldn't be there. If they are going to arrest people for opposing the regime, make the sons of bitches plant or fabricate the evidence from the get-go. Now, beyond that, I'm not going to comment on this particular incident any further at this time because the exact sequence of events is not clear. Like Sherlock Holmes once said, it's a capital mistake to theorize without data. And, of course, I would never attempt to find humor or satisfaction in the death of a woman who was an integral part of the most utterly vicious and corrupt political system in human history, or in the death of a man who was paid a large salary to send other human beings into the closest approximation to hell on earth that mankind has ever devised.
About the time my daddy left to fight the big war, I saw my first pistol in the general store, in the general store. Well, I was 13, I thought it was the finest thing I ever had seen. So I asked if I could have one someday when I grew up. Mama dropped a dozen eggs, she really blew up. Yes, she really blew up. She didn't understand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. My very first pistol was a cap and ball coat. Shoot as fast as lightning, but it loads a mile slow. It loads a mile slow. And soon I found out it'll get you into trouble, but it can't get you out. About a year later, got a Colt 45. Called a peacemaker, but I never knew why. I never knew why. I didn't understand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. Card game in a Cumberland town. Caught a minor cheating, so I shot the dog down. Shot the dog down. Watched the man fall. Never touched his holster, never had a chance to call. The trial was in the morning, then they brought me out of bed. Asked me how I pleaded, not guilty, I said. Not guilty, I said. You got the wrong man. Left and touched the trigger, but the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand, the devil's right hand. Nothing touched the trigger but the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand, the devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand.
Okay, now listen up, guys. This is serious now. What I'm going to do is something I think I actually did early last summer. I'm going to replay a commentary that I made back in February of last year when a man named Joseph Stack flew his airplane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas in a kind of kamikaze mission because he had been so badly fucked over and his life destroyed by America. I want everyone to listen very carefully to what I have to say in this short cast because in it I make crystal clear what my true attitude towards individual acts of violence is. If and when I'm ever arrested by the secret police and charged by the regime for allegedly inciting something or whatever, I will probably just play this one short podcast as my defense. So listen up, guys. This is the real deal. This is Harold Covington speaking, and the date is February the 18th, 2010. This morning, at around 10 o'clock Central Standard Time, a man named Joseph Stack crashed a light aircraft into the Internal Revenue Service offices in the Federal Building in Austin, Texas. He left behind a long online manifesto, or final communication, in which he described with great passion and somewhat less coherence the shafting that, like so many white men of his generation, he received at the hands of the America he was raised to believe in. At the present time, the authorities are only admitting to Stack himself being dead. Looks like the poor bastard didn't even manage to take a single bureaucrat in a suit with him. It's not clear at this point whether Stack had any white racial leanings or not, but his is a condition of mind and soul we can all sympathize with. To quote his own farewell address to the world, he said, "I have just had enough." In this, he speaks for all white Americans, and his willingness to make his point by giving up his own life tells us that, at least, he meant what he said. I've spoken before in my writings of what the radicals of the 19th century referred to as the propaganda of the deed. Well, this was it. Was his act a complete waste? I hope not, but I'm not sanguine about his chances of accomplishing anything. Americans mostly exist on a Beavis and Butthead level. Symbolic gestures like Stack's go right over their heads. But I want to take this opportunity to speak to all of you out there, both men of Stack's generation and mine, and also to young white kids who have been raised under political correctness and who understand that America no longer holds out any hope or any future for them. Time and again, over the past 40 years, I've seen white men snap like this. They go to a shopping mall or a former workplace armed with a couple of semi-autos, and they come in the door smoking, or else just go off on a pointless spree, blasting anything black or brown that moves until the cops catch up with him, and either the guy gets shot by the police or else he sticks the muzzle in his own mouth and he blows himself away. I know that right now there are untold numbers of angry white males out there who have been driven to the point of homicidal rage by the terrible injustice, the unfairness, and the tyranny of mind, body, and spirit, which is Obama's America in 2010. I know some of you in the back of your minds are contemplating doing something of this nature. You wouldn't be human if you weren't. I know some of you listening to my voice right now are thinking in your desperation and your righteous rage at the wrongs that America has done to you that going out in a blaze of glory might just be worth it. I'm telling you now, no, it isn't. There are practical reasons why it isn't worth it. Not the least being that there's no way you could possibly inflict enough damage on the enemy to justify the sacrifice of a single racially aware white life. There are so few, so terribly few of us, and every one of you is precious to me and to our racial future. If you were able to kill 100 or 1,000 street niggers or Mexicans or federal bureaucrats, the scales still wouldn't balance in our favor. I'm reminded of the words of General George Patton, who said, "Nobody ever won a war by dying for his country. You win by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country." You may reply, "It's my life and I can give it up when and how I want." No, it isn't. Your life belongs to your people and to the moment of history into which you have been born, and it is not yours to throw away. The late Pastor Robert Miles once said, "A racist is someone who knows who he is." If you have attained the precious gift of racial consciousness, of knowing who you are, then it is your inescapable duty to use that consciousness to secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. You are not in this for yourself, for your own benefit, or your own private vengeance. Now, there have been ages in the past wherein white men were free to live for themselves and their own desires. This time and place we live in is not one of them. Many of you will have read my Northwest Independence novels, and I want to remind you of what I had a number of my characters say in all four of those books in one form or another. The duty of a revolutionary is not to kill people, but to free people. Our goal is to change the world, and all of our personal lives, actions, and decisions must be subordinated to that objective. Any damn fool can die for his country and his cause. Only a true patriot and a man of honor and integrity can find within himself the strength of character, the self-discipline, and the iron will to live for it. That kind of moral strength and character is what I demand of everyone associated with the Northwest Front, and it is what all of you should demand of yourselves. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Andaban. Freedom.